Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
In ancient times, being a senior was apparently no big deal. The Bible's Methuselah, 10 centuries and change. Busy Abraham waited until he was 100 and his wife Sarah 91 before they settled down to have their first child, Isaac. Peng Zhu, 4,000 years ago, according to Chinese legend, saw his 800th birthday. Tiresias in ancient Greece had a sight impairment, which may explain his early death at just over a reported 600 years. No exercise program, interested meditation, or suggested diet from these aged men and women has survived for us to try and emulate, so there you have it, a mystery. We 21st century humans are just going to have to be humble about all of this. From Cadillac, Michigan, one of you says, I don't know, but I imagine I would grow tired of life after 100 years. If everyone could become centenarians, I would fear the cost to society and lack of jobs. Or Dave, who tells us, it's all relative. A few years ago, I acquired a form of leukemia that was lethal 20 years ago. With new targeted drug therapies, my life expectancy is now typical. My typical mortality is sweeter than any promise of immortality. Shelley Kagan, the Clark Professor of Philosophy at Yale University, says that a vastly greater life expectancy around the world poses fundamental identity questions for each of us, questions about who exactly we are.
Well, if people suddenly lived to, instead of living to 80, on average lived to 150, that would double the population, which means then we don't have room for everybody. And so that implies that we would then have to cut back on the number of children that people have. Right away, that pushes families in different directions from the ones we're used to. Leaves the question, what happens to the parents? Instead of having the 20 years plus that we're raising the children in the house now, we would have decades, really 50 or more years, in which we were still in prime health, at least that's what we're imagining, but our children would have left the home. And so now the central project of our lives for most of us currently, raising our children, has to recede. And so we then have to ask, what's replacing that? Does the role of being a grandparent become a more significant one? Does the role of becoming a great-grandparent or a great-great-grandparent, a role that doesn't even exist now for all practical purposes, does that become a significant one? What would that look like?
It seems like we evolve back to a sense more of extended families rather than siloed individuals. I mean, the idea of parenting under this scenario of living 150 years becomes an episode kind of like high school. I mean, sure.
That's right. Exactly. And so one possibility, the one you just sketched, is that extended families across many generations might come to the fore. But of course, a completely different possibility is that family recedes from importance and that we won't have deep connections with our great-grandchildren or our great-great-grandchildren or our great-great-great-grandchildren. And so family life would have to become a less important part of our life than it currently is. You can't simply add 50 years or 80 years to our lifespan and think you're just going to plop that into life as we know it and everything else stays the same. Suppose that technology got to the point where we could replace organs at will with synthetic livers, synthetic lungs, so forth and so on as things wear out. And so now we can live, in principle, it looks as though we can live in centuries or longer. But then we have to ask what's happening to the human brain. The human brain, like any other organ, would eventually wear out, presumably. So imagine that the scenario that now is that when that stage is approaching, we upload the human personality of the given individual onto some computer chip or synthetic brain so that all of your memories and desires and beliefs and goals and ambitions are uploaded onto this chip, which is then that chip then gets placed in to the new synthetic brain. That offers a scenario in which conceivably we might continue to live, but now we have to face the philosophical question, is that still you?
Yeah. Who is you? Are you a physical domain, or are you simply an embodiment? And again, you know, who you are at age 20 is different from who you are at age 80, which then would be different from who you are at age 150.
Right. There's a very deep philosophical question. It's known as the nature of personal identity or the persistence of identity across time. That the thought that almost all of us work with is that although I've changed in many, many ways from the person I was when I was 20, I have many new experiences, many new goals, lots of different memories from the person that I was when I was 20, and I'll be different yet again if I make it to 80. But for all that, there's a single person that has persisted through these changes. I've survived those changes. But there's a quite complicated philosophical issue of what kinds of changes are changes I can survive and what kinds of changes are changes that I can't survive. If we have the person with the brain copy or the duplicate, is that me? Am I surviving the change of brain? Or is that rather simply a kind of Xerox of me? Really, we have to turn strictly to philosophical speculation, metaphysics, to face the question of what kinds of changes can I survive? So how long can I live and still have it be, strictly speaking, me?
Well, thinking about scenarios and episodes in history that we can barely imagine today, going back to the 14th century, I've read a fair amount of history about what went on then. There was the Black Death, and it was the center of the medieval period where infant mortality was high, life expectancy was very, very low, and virtually everything about that time was involved with preparing for the afterlife, a sense of life itself having no value here, that everything was preparation for some judgment of piety that would take place towards the end of your life. It affected everything, every outlook. And it was all about this notion that life is short. Does an extension of life increase the value of life, do you think?
Right, throughout much of human history, because people, of course, don't, for the most part, welcome the prospect of death. They've held out the hope of surviving their deaths and there being some kind of an afterlife. And so when you change the vision of the world from a mere first act to the only act, that really does, I think, shift your focus on what you want to do with this life. If this world, this life, the 70, 80, 90 years, if I'm lucky, that I have are all I've got, I have to be sure to not waste that time, to spend my life in such a way that it's as valuable and makes the greatest possible contribution.
Although there's a limited incentive for getting off the couch at age 75 if you know you're going to live to 105.
Well, actually, an interesting question again about if you imagine life going on longer is where do the extra years fall in terms of our life story? Do we imagine the extra 30, 40, whatever it might be, the extra years coming after we've retired? That's a difficulty right away because most people currently don't save enough money for a retirement, let alone a retirement that's now two times as long, three times as long, four times as long. If instead you imagine the extra years coming during our working years, then which kinds of jobs are going to be sufficiently interesting to sustain our interest to work at the job for 80 years or 90 years or 100 years? Or do we instead imagine that what's going to happen is that people will at a certain point change careers, perhaps at the point where we would normally nowadays be retiring? But how's that going to work? I mean, who at the age of 60 or 70 or 80 is going to want to start over again at the lowest rung in their new chosen profession? So as I say, you can say we're going to use science to extend our lifespan by a relatively modest amount, adding another 20 or 30 years. But it's not at all obvious what kinds of changes we need to have in society in order to absorb even as modest a change as that.
Shelley Kagan is the Clark Professor of Philosophy at Yale University. Thanks so much.
It's been my pleasure.